This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. If you listen to Solving JFK a lot, you know that I like to keep the vibes up. And that's why I'm a fan of federally legal cannabis from Mood.com. It's a brand that uses small organic farms to source its pesticide-free legal weed. You can get 20% off of your first order at Mood.com by using code JFK. My favorite product of theirs is the functional THC gummies. Usually I go with Epic Euphoria, but I also like Magic Mind and the Pure Relief CBD gummies. These legal weed gummies take about 20 minutes to kick in, and you can control the dosage yourself. Unlike the federal government, Mood.com has never sold drugs to fund illegal wars or clandestine missions. Thanks, Mood.com. So try out some of the excellent legal cannabis products from Mood.com and get a 20% discount off of your first order using code JFK. Did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body really is? It's true, your biological age, the age of your cells and organs, is actually the number one predictor of your risk for serious diseases like heart disease, cancer, dementia, and more. That's why learning your biological age can be truly life-changing, and that's exactly what the True Age test from True Diagnostic helps you do. With just a simple at-home test, you can uncover your true biological age and get personalized insights to help you take control of your health like never before. No doctor visits, no labs, just a quick finger prick from the comfort of your own home. True Diagnostic doesn't just tell you your biological age, it gives you a personalized report that's full of clear, science-backed steps that you can take to actually slow down aging and improve your health over time. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com. You can use the code JFK to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code JFK at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. We've been looking at key mafia figures who were most likely to have been involved in a plot to kill President Kennedy. In the last episode, we talked about Jimmy Hoffa, Meyer Lansky, and Sam Giancana. In this episode, we pick up where we left off by studying Johnny Rosselli and Santos Traficante to try to gain an understanding of whether there's any truth to the idea that the mafia, or anyone affiliated with it, was involved in President Kennedy's murder.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? The mission answers, he acted alone.
I'm working.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. Filippo Sacco was born in Esperia, Italy, and moved with his family to the United States, specifically Boston, as a 6-year-old. He began using the name John Roselli as an 18-year-old in Chicago when he was on the run from a narcotics charge in Boston. Roselli eventually made his way out to Los Angeles, where he was arrested for bootlegging in 1924. After being an independent hoodlum for a while, Roselli met Al Capone while he was in Chicago to watch a boxing match in 1927. Capone invited Roselli to a party at the Metropole Hotel, where he hit it off with the Chicago outfit. This led to Roselli working with the Los Angeles Mafia to monitor Al Capone's investments in LA. Roselli used his time out west to forcibly take over offshore gambling on a casino ship called the Mal Falcone. He also worked in the movie business, producing several gangster films. He cut his teeth working with the government as the de facto liaison between the mafia or any other criminals and corrupt Los Angeles mayor Frank Shaw. Roselli's past came back to haunt him while he was serving in the army during World War II. He was convicted of extortion in 1943, resulting in an undesirable discharge from the service and a 3-year stint in prison. Years later, when Las Vegas was taking off in the 1950s, Johnny Roselli became the official representative of the Chicago and Los Angeles Mafia in Sin City. Roselli made sure that all of the various organized crime interests got their cut of the skim from legal gambling. As we covered in episode 80, when the CIA wanted the help of organized crime to kill Fidel Castro, Johnny Roselli was the go-between for CIA cutout Robert Mayhew and the Mafia. According to what the CIA told the Church Committee, all cooperation between the CIA and the Mafia, specifically Roselli, ended in mid-February of 1963. Roselli was determined to stay involved, even though he was officially on the sidelines. In an effort to get funding from Robert Kennedy, who had been handed the Cuba issue by his brother, Roselli put together a mafia-backed Cuban exile group called the Junta of the Government of Cuba in Exile. CIA agent Bernard Barker, who was also working for Traficante, helped to spread the word about the new organization among Cuban exiles. The group fizzled out in May of 1963 when it was discovered that its leader, Paulino Sierra, had been funded by Johnny Roselli. According to Army officer Bradley Ayers, Roselli was working with Cuban exiles long after Bill Harvey officially told him to let his Cuban contacts taper off. Ayers was sent to South Florida to help the CIA's JM Wave station develop paramilitary capabilities. According to Ayers, Roselli was right there in the middle of all of the Cuban exiles and the CIA officers as they prepared various missions against Castro from the Florida Keys in the summer and fall of 1963. Ayers knew him as Colonel Roselli and often saw him coming and going from the office of David Morales, as well as driving around the JM Wave complex with Gordon Campbell and David Atlee Phillips. According to the CIA's Office of Public Affairs, Ayers was detailed to work with the CIA from May of 1963 until December of 1964. That means that the earliest that Ayers could have seen Roselli would have been after Roselli was supposed to no longer be involved with the exiles. Years later, when the United States government attempted to deport Roselli, he asked the CIA for help. The agency refused to assist him. At that point, Roselli revealed the plot to kill Castro to columnist Jack Anderson. This led to Roselli being called to testify before the Church Committee, which, as we mentioned in previous episodes, was looking into the actions and excesses of intelligence agencies. Not long after his June 1976 testimony to the Church Committee, and not long after the June 19th murder of Sam G. and Khanna, Johnny Rosselli disappeared on July 28, 1976. His dismembered body was found inside of a 55-gallon drum in Miami's Dumfoundling Bay. As Rosselli's body decomposed, the drum rose to the surface. An October 24, 1978 Washington Post article suggests that Santos Traficante may have been responsible for killing Rosselli. The article says, quote, 12 days before his death, Rosselli dined with Traficante at the fashionable Landings restaurant in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It is the custom in the mafia to wine and dine a wayward member before he is executed. Underworld informants told police that Rosselli was lured aboard a private boat by his executioners. It is also the mafia's practice to give murder contracts to friends who the victim trusts. Further, Santos Traficante owned a home at 740 Northeast 155th Street in Miami, which is not far from Dumfoundling Bay, where Rosselli's body was discovered. Rosselli made it clear to the Church Committee Counsel, Michael Madigan, that he was afraid for his safety and he was taking a major risk by testifying. Madigan noted, quote, I cannot recall Rosselli saying who he specifically was most afraid of, but he declined to testify about Giancana until after Giancana's death, refused to identify any of the Cubans who were involved in the assassination plots, and was reluctant to mention Santos Traficante by name. In fact, I cannot recall Rosselli ever mentioning Traficante by name. It is also my recollection that Rosselli's demeanor was visibly affected whenever testimony or interview focused or attempted to focus on Santos Traficante. So there is some evidence suggesting that Traficante may have killed Rosselli, but it's not definitive. Santos Traficante is also the next mob boss we have on deck. First of all, this guy's first name is pronounced with or without the S at the end all over the place. After waffling on this pronunciation for a while, until someone can persuade me otherwise, I'm going with Santos Traficante because that's what he told the House Select Committee on Assassinations his name was, as noted in the official transcript from when he testified. Santos Traficante Jr. was born in Tampa to parents who had migrated from Sicily. His father, Santos Traficante Sr., was the mafia don in Tampa from the early 1940s until his death from natural causes in 1954. The elder Traficante showed his son the ropes of the criminal family business. Santos Jr. helped to create and maintain an international narcotics trafficking network with the Lucchese crime family out of New York. In 1946, Traficante Sr. sent his son to Cuba to help operate a mafia-owned casino. In 1950, both Santos Traficante Jr. and Sr. fled to Cuba to avoid being subpoenaed to testify before the Kefauver Committee on Organized Crime in the Senate. While the Traficantes were gone, two other mobsters, Jimmy Lumia and Charlie Wall, battled for control of Tampa. When the Traficantes returned to Tampa, they had Lumia killed. Then, after Charlie Wall tried to kill Santos Jr., the family eliminated Wall in short order, leaving the Traficante crime family in charge of Tampa once again. When he took over after his father's death, Santos Jr. became one of the most powerful mob bosses in America, doing business with many other families and extending his influence to the Bahamas and the Caribbean. While his reach was global, Traficante was especially keen on Cuba, which he knew well. In 1955, Traficante Jr. continued to spend a lot of time in Cuba, where he met Meyer Lansky. At that time, under the Fulgencio Batista regime, Traficante had an ownership interest in and helped to operate the San Suchi Cabaret and seven different Cuban casinos, which included the Havana Hilton. The reality of operating in Cuba meant that Traficante needed to have a local criminal infrastructure. Just like mafia schemes anywhere else, there had to be a chain of command with soldiers on the front line doing the dirty work. According to what an aide to RFK told authors Tom Hartman and Lamar Waldron, Cuban exile, CIA asset, and Watergate burglar Bernard Barker was working for Traficante before, during, and after his time with the CIA. This is notable because Barker worked for E. Howard Hunt, and Barker is the person who Dallas police officer Seymour Weitzman identified as the Secret Service agent on the Grassy Knoll. As mentioned in episode 80, CIA asset Tony Verona was being bribed by Traficante to ensure gambling, prostitution, and drug monopolies in Cuba for the mafia if Castro could be ousted. Herminio Diaz Garcia worked for Tony Verona in Cuba. He would go on to become a bodyguard and hitman for Traficante, while also participating in the CIA mafia plots beginning in 1963. As we'll soon see, Barker, Verona, and Diaz Garcia were just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Cuban exiles working with the CIA, who were also aligned with Santos Traficante. On top of that, there's an allegation, which very well may be true, that Jack Ruby met with Traficante in a Cuban prison. We'll cover that claim in depth when we revisit the life of Jack Ruby in just a few episodes. I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay, sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick five-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. The products from Uncommon Goods are high quality, they're unique, a lot of times they're handmade, and they're made in the United States. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses. And because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to Uncommon Goods when I didn't know what to get that person who seemed to already have everything. Another great thing about Uncommon Goods is that they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice every time you buy something. So far, they've donated over $3 million to nonprofits. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/JFK. That's uncommongoods.com/JFK for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. As previously noted in episode 68, FBI informant and Cuban exile Jose Alemán says that he met with Santos Traficante in September of 1962 and told him that he thought Kennedy would be reelected, to which Traficante responded, quote, "You don't understand me. Kennedy's not going to make it to the election. He's going to get hit." Traficante appeared before the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1978, and while he admitted to meeting with Aleman about a Teamster loan proposal, he denied that he said anything about killing President Kennedy. However, years later, an associate at a connected law firm would go on to share everything the Tampa Don told the firm about the JFK assassination. Daniel Sheehan worked as an associate in the office of attorney F. Lee Bailey, whose name might ring a bell because he went on to be one of the attorneys for O.J. Simpson. The Harvard-educated Sheehan also had an epic legal career, including working on the Pentagon Papers case and suing the Reagan-Bush administration in a case that led to the discovery of the Iran-Contra scandal. While Sheehan was working for F. Lee Bailey, he learned that the firm was on Index 4, a list of attorneys cleared by the CIA to defend agency-related clients on sensitive matters. Sheehan was brought in to help defend Watergate burglar James McCord. Right off the bat, Sheehan had some questions, and this is where Santos Traficante comes in. Here's Sheehan talking about his representation of McCord on the Julian Dory show.
If I'm being asked to participate in this, I need to find out what happened. What in the world are three of these Traficante gunmen doing in the Watergate Hotel? What has that got to do with anything? And I started investigating it and found out that that Bailey was the attorney for Santos Traficante. And so I said, oh, look, Traficante obviously must know what his guys are doing in there. So let's find out what's going on. So we have Bat Andy Tooney, who was our chief investigator, that he was the head of a thing called Moriarty & Associates. It's got 40 Class A licensed private investigators that are at our disposal at the Bailey firm, right? And he goes and sits down. He goes down to Tampa.
Tampa, yeah.
Over in Tampa, brings in Traficante and brings him over to Hank Gonzalez's house. Bat Andy spends the weekend with him, interviewing him in the guest house, and gets the story about what's happened here. And he ends up telling us that what's happened. And what we discovered is that the reason that, in fact, it had been Nixon himself that had personally ordered them to go into the Watergate Hotel. It wasn't just a brain fart or something on the part of the plumbers unit. That this was actually ordered by Nixon himself.
He's telling you.
Yeah, this is Traficante is being very clear about this, that this was ordered by Nixon himself, because Nixon was terrified that Larry O'Brien. Lawrence O'Brien had just been made the head of the new head of the Democratic National Committee that June, and was going to be supervising the campaign against Nixon. And it turns out that Larry O'Brien, prior to being made the head of the Democratic National Committee, was the 20-year lobbyist, chief lobbyist in Washington, D.C. for Howard Hughes. Turns out that Howard Hughes is the guy back in 1960,
yep,
when Richard Nixon was the vice president under Eisenhower, and realized that he was going to be the nominee for the Republican Party for the presidential nomination in 1960 against John Kennedy. He reached out and contacted Howard Hughes, who was a secret consultant to the National Security Council of the Eisenhower-Nixon administration. Nixon reached out to him on the secure phone from the 5412 committee, which is the section of the National Security Act of 1947 that ostensibly authorizes them to engage in other activities from time to time at the behest of the president. And they deemed that as being the source of their authority to engage in covert operations, what they call kinetic action.
Yeah.
And so that Nixon reached out on the secure phone to talk to Howard Hughes, asking him to set up a political assassination team to kill Fidel Castro.
In 1960, while he's vice president.
Well, he's vice president.
So, according to Sheehan, Traficante said it was Richard Nixon who ordered the CIA to work with the mafia. Sheehan's story from Traficante about the Mayhew-connected plots largely confirms everything we covered in episode 80. As already noted, many of the Cubans who were working with the CIA against Castro were on Traficante's payroll. One major difference between the Church Committee account and what Traficante says is that Traficante includes Sheffield Edwards, the director of security for the CIA, as being present at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami. The Church Committee says that a lower-ranking CIA official, Jerry O'Connell, was the highest-ranking government representative. The most significant addition to the official Church Committee story is that after meeting with Sheffield Edwards, Traficante, who had been operating in Cuba for decades at this point, was given the green light to create what he called the S-Force. Here's Sheehan talking about how Traficante put the team together on the Julian Dory show.
And Santos Traficante then picks 15 guys that are his former gunmen from Havana who have been recruited. He wants to make sure that all the guys that he recruits into this S-Force, he's called, that are people that are working with the Central Intelligence Agency now in a thing called Operation 40. Operation 40 was this covert operation that was being mounted out of five paramilitary bases that had been established all through the southeastern United States. You know, one on Swan Island, one on No Name Key, one in the Everglades, and then two of them at Lake Pontchartrain over in Louisiana.
Yep.
They're all set up, and they've got CIA liaison people functioning to them, but they're made up of a lot of the anti-Castro, pro-Batista, right-wing Cuban organized crime guys that were working with Traficante in all the different gambling casinos and houses of prostitution and heroin trafficking they had going through Havana under Batista. These guys are all operatives now working with the Central Intelligence Agency in a thing called Operation 40. And then comes the election time after setting all this up in June, and they set up a scheme for financing the training of this S-Force that they were taking a skim off the casinos, off the two major mob casinos. I think one is the Flamingo and one's the
right.
Sands. And they were skimming cash off of them, and they were putting them in these brand new expensive suitcases and putting them in the trunks of Cadillac automobiles and then driving them down from Las Vegas through New Orleans, where Marcella would do the audit on what the cash was that was coming off the skim. Then they would pack them back up and they'd take them into Miami and they'd put them in the Miami National Bank of Meyer Lansky, the bank down there. And then what they would do is they would wire some of that money down to a bank account down in the Banco Internacional in Mexico City. And they would put this cash into this bank account of a lawyer by the name of Ogario, his name was. Manuel Agario, and they put the money in there, and that money was used to finance the training that was taking place of this triangular fire team base that was down in Oaxaca, Mexico, on the ranch of Clint Murchison Jr.
Sheehan says that Traficante flat out admitted helping to assemble the assassination team that ended up killing President Kennedy. But Traficante said that he's not the one who ordered the hit.
He said, look, I, Santos Traficante, am the one that put together the assassination team that killed President Kennedy. He said, but I didn't put it together to kill President Kennedy. I put it together to kill Fidel Castro. And we did this back in late June. I was first contacted, he said, of 1960. In 1960, Richard Nixon was the vice president under Eisenhower, and in that capacity, he chaired the 5412 Committee of the National Security Council, which is the council that coordinates covert operations of the Central Intelligence Agency under Section 5412 of the National Security Act of 1947.
So what does all of this have to do with Watergate and Sheehan's client, James McCord? The FBI found sequentially numbered $100 bills in the pockets of all of the Watergate burglars. The bills were then traced back to the bank account of Manuel Agario at the Banco Internacional in Mexico City. According to Sheehan, the Watergate burglary was really about Nixon sending in his operatives to bug the phones and plant listening devices at the DNC headquarters because Nixon was worried that Howard Hughes' old lobbyist, who was the new head of the DNC, Larry O'Brien, knew that Nixon was the one who first reached out to Hughes to work with the mafia, which, Traficante says, led to the creation of the assassin team that killed President Kennedy. Nixon was apparently worried that O'Brien would use that information against him in the 1972 campaign. Here's Sheehan again.
As it turns out, the account down in Banco Internacional in Mexico City of Manuel Agario is the same account through which they passed the money that was being taken from the skim off the three casinos in Vegas back in 1960 and paid down to the Triangular Fire Team training base down in Oaxaca, Mexico, that was owned by Clint Murchison Jr., where the assassination team was trained by Carl Jenkins, whom I've spoken with at length. This is where they were being trained. And what it means is that if, in fact, that bank had been investigated by Mark Felt and found out that the money for the burglars in Watergate had come directly from the same account that had been used to pay the assassination base that was being trained down in Oaxaca, Mexico, all that would have come out. It turns out that that's what the problem was here.
The story that Daniel Sheehan lays out, as told to him by Santos Traficante, is one of intermingling between the mafia, the CIA, and Cuban exiles. There is much more to this story, especially the details around Nixon and the CIA, which we'll revisit in the future. We're putting a lot of faith in the word of one man if we believe this story. But Daniel Sheehan isn't just some guy. He's a bona fide legal legend and a man in the arena. I'm not saying that the case has been solved, but we certainly have to consider Sheehan's claims. We'll keep what Sheehan said in mind and revisit the details of Traficante's story as relayed by Sheehan when we get to the Cuban exiles. Next time on Solving JFK, we wrap up our study of mafia bosses with a look at Carlos Marcello, including alleged links between Marcello and Lee Harvey Oswald and Marcello's alleged jailhouse confession. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.